So here's a question for you. Why do we cook? No other animals do, but we are meticulous about food, often scouring shelves for the right brand of almond milk, the right type of salt. Should we get kosher or regular? The right type of apple? Should we get Gala or Granny Smith? So what can science tell us about why we are like this, why we care, and how food sets humans apart as a species? My next guest has looked for some answers. David Pogue is a technology columnist for the New York Times and the host of Nova Science Now, whose upcoming episode is Can I Eat That? David Pogue, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So let me just start with a question about you. How big a cook are you? How focused on food were you before you started really looking into this topic?
Oh, man, how big a cook I am? Am I? Wow. Well, if there is a scale and there's Julia Child on it and Master Chefs on it, I'm at the far left end. I can pour milk on cereal. But that doesn't mean I'm not an appreciative eater.
Okay.
I've learned a lot about food and eating, especially through shooting this episode.
So then the real big question is, why do we cook? I mean, we sort of take it for granted, but do you look around at other animals that are out there catching grubs and that kind of thing, and you think, well, why don't we eat our food raw like everybody else does?
Yeah, well, it's incredible. That is an essential question, one of the ones we try to answer on this show. It turns out that we are the only animal that cooks, and not only that, we have to cook. If we were to try to consume a raw diet, as some people do, you will lose weight, you will not be able to raise children, and you will die off. It's because our ancestors spent so much time and energy chewing. I mean, hours and hours a day chewing, that you can't ever get ahead calorically. And not only that, but we learned that cooking gave rise to physical changes in our bodies. If you compare us to the great apes, for example, our teeth are completely different. They're not fangs. They're much smaller and more delicate. Great apes often have this ridge across the top of their skulls, and the purpose of that ridge was for the giant jaw muscles to connect. That's what they held on to at the top of the head. Well, we don't need those giant jaw muscles because we're not ripping through uncooked food anymore. We've let the cooking do the energy of breaking down some of the food for us, so we don't need that ridge. And our abdomens are much smaller. We can get by with much less food. So anyway, it's just an astonishing lesson to me that cooking had a huge evolutionary purpose.
So back at the beginning, there was a lot of time spent chewing raw food, and somehow the people who were able to deal with their food in a different way, to streamline it, were able to build more efficient societies.
Well, that's right. And also, if you think about the social nature of humanity, before there was cooking, everybody was gathering food all the time. But our scientist makes the case that with the advent of cooking, it began to break down the family structure by gender lines, that women could afford to be home and spend more time with children, and men didn't have to spend all their time hunting. So there arose things like language and socializing.
So if we hurtle into the 20th century, the 21st century, the role of chemistry in cooking is really interesting. And I wonder how you think the sort of modern chemical industry has changed cooking and has changed fundamentally taste.
Oh, man, this blew my mind. So in this episode, we visited a food chemical company, basically a food design company in California, and they are hired by Mrs. Fields or McDonald's or Stouffer's or whoever to come up with their new recipes. So you get some frozen meal in the refrigerator and you think, you know, Budget Gourmet came up with that recipe. They didn't. They hired it out to one of these companies that designs foods. And the day we were there, they were working on several new food products for some of the big companies. And one of them was a Mexican frozen dish, and they had a line of small vials of scent chemicals that were supposed to connote Mexican scents. And they were just chemicals. They were, you know, benzoin, pyridoxine, hydrochloride, whatever. I don't remember the names. But the point is they were experimenting with which chemical could they put into this food that would not add any flavor but would give it the scent of something Mexican. And I was really offended by that at first and disgusted by that. But they very patiently throughout the day pointed out that all cooking, all recipes are a matter of mixing together chemicals. What? Why do you think we add vanilla to baking? Well, that's not disgusting, but it's a chemical, and we add it for scent and flavor. What about yeast? We put living organisms into our food expressly so that it will make the dough rise and form little bubbles of output gases. Well, that's vile too, if you really want to think about it. So they made the point that all food ultimately comes from somewhere, and all recipes are ultimately a combination of chemicals to make it taste a certain way.
But
so I had to back off a little.
But so does that mean that the food industry, big food, let's say, as opposed to what you make in your kitchen, has this inherent advantage because they're able to play with chemicals in a way that, I mean, you pointed out vanilla and yeast, but in your kitchen, it is almost beyond the realm of options that you have.
Well, absolutely. So we're never going to be able to. I mean, just yesterday, my daughter brought home some Halloween cookies, and they taste completely different from homemade cookies, obviously. But she loved them. I mean, they were obviously they have that store bought cookie taste, frankly.
Right.
So yeah, there's a totally different set of chemicals in our kitchens as compared to these food corporation kitchens. And you know, by the way, I'm not saying that all disgusting processed food is okay and it's all the same. I'm not trying to say that. There is certainly a line that can be crossed. But if the whole argument is, ew, you shouldn't put chemicals into your food for the purpose of manipulating its flavor, well, that's where I say, well, wait a minute. That's all any cook does.
I wonder if you think that obesity is somewhat of a byproduct of this amazing ability we have now to manipulate taste. If we can optimize the flavor of everything in a way we couldn't 500, 1,000 years ago, is it possible that we're sort of pressing our genetic buttons all the time?
I suppose it's possible. The obesity thing fascinates me, and there are 1,000 different theories as to what's going on. Is it the rise of corn syrup? Is it the rise of transportation? Is it the rise of the internet? Is it, you know, nobody who's really pegged it down, but there's a lot of theories, and certainly the quantities of food, the quantities of servings has gone up astronomically, the caloric content, the fat content of what we eat. So there are a lot of pieces to that one.
Sort of figuring out how to maximize things. I wonder, too, I know you looked at this issue of the perception of taste and the idea that the perception of taste goes beyond just food. It may go beyond what chemicals or how much fat is in food. What when we think, oh, this dish tastes really good, what enters into that besides just taste?
Wow, that was another amazing revelation. I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard the old saw that 90% of taste is actually smell. Turns out it's baloney. First of all, how could you ever measure that? Certainly smell is a component of taste. And food scientists don't say taste. They say flavor when they mean the entire experience of scent and taste. One of the things that I wondered going in to talk to these taste scientists is, okay, scent is so much of flavor, but I don't get it because once you've put the bite in your mouth is closed. How is the scent supposed to get back out of your mouth and up into your nostrils? And that's the big misconception. It doesn't. That's not what they're talking about. The flavor goes to the back of your mouth, and the scent goes up inside your head into your nose. It's not coming through your nostrils. So it is a great deal to do with scent. But it's not coming through your nostrils. It's going up the back. And we went to one of the world's leading experts on taste buds. You know, those little bumps on your tongue. I always thought those were taste buds. Those aren't the taste buds. Those are called fungiform papillae, which is why nobody ever refers to them. But each fungiform papilla has about 6 taste buds on it, tiny little things you can't see except under a microscope. And those are the actual taste buds. The other huge lesson of that visit was we all have different numbers of them. If you they put a three-ring binder hole punch size hole ring on your tongue, and that's the standard measurement unit. They count how many fungiform papilla you have in the space of that little round hole, and it can range from 6 to 60. And I shockingly have 60 of them, which means that I could be what they call a super taster. It doesn't mean I'm especially good one, but it means that I experience far more flavor than somebody with only 20 or 10. And so therefore, people should stop making fun of me when I eat something spicy and go, ow, ow, it's too spicy. It's not a matter of my being a wussy. It's a matter of my experiencing it far more intensely. And our scientist was saying, she was saying, this is the big myth among young parents, is they keep shoving food into their baby's mouths, their children's mouths. If the kid doesn't like it, don't say there's something wrong with you, child, for not liking this perfectly healthy food. Consider the fact that your child isn't experiencing it the same way you are.
Now, what's the difference between a super taster and a regular taster? Does the super taster tend to be more discriminating about what they like, or they might like the same number of things, but they, like you said, just experience them differently?
If I understand this correctly, it's that they just experience things more intensely, all of it. Doesn't make them better people.
Okay. So far, that's what we know so far.
Right.
Okay. You also looked at, there's a sort of a breed of people now who delight in messing with your senses. And I know you've got some really interesting restaurants in New York that do that. And they will sort of make food that looks like one kind of food, but it's actually made out of something else. And I wonder, have you been to any of these restaurants? And how does that work in terms of sort of messing with perception versus reality?
I haven't been to one of those restaurants, but at that food design company we visited, they did play some amazing tricks on me. So for example, I was asked to hold my nose, and I was fed a jelly bean and asked to identify the flavor. And it just tasted like sweet. It was just obviously a jelly bean, but it had no fruit flavor. And then I was allowed to unplug my nose, and suddenly it was very obviously tangerine. And that actually goes back to the earlier notion of scent playing a huge role. In the case of jelly beans, almost the entire flavor is determined by its odor and not by its taste. But the other experiment, more to your question, is they had me drink a new kind of orange juice that they said they were developing. And it looked like any old frozen orange juice. It was orange and thick looking. But it was alarmingly different tasting. It was really pleasant. It was really good and crisp and fresh. But very shockingly different from most orange juices. And they stood there on filming me on national TV remarking about how different this kind of orange must be, they revealed that, in fact, it was apple juice. It was just apple juice that they'd colored to look like orange juice. And, of course, if my eyes had been closed, I would have said, oh, that's really good apple juice. But the fact that they told me it was orange juice and it looked like orange juice, it threw my brain into a confused tizzy to the point that I could no longer identify it as either apple or orange.
Interesting that there's sort of convergence of the senses there.
That's right. So they were deliberately throwing me off through the sight of something. And one of our scientists at Harvard actually pointed out that really all five senses play into your experience of food. In fact, going back to that food company one more time, she did a test. She blindfolded me, and she had two mugs in front of her, coffee mugs. And into one, she poured cold water from a pitcher, and into the other, she poured hot water from a pitcher. I could tell which was cold and which was hot by the sound. I mean, you could do this too, but it's true. Hot and cold water sound different. So, yeah, it's sound, it's sight, it's touch, it's sense. It's all five it's all five senses at once that play into how you experience the food.
And final question about this. One of the things, of course, that's coming right around the corner is Thanksgiving. And you looked at some of the chemistry behind Thanksgiving, which is always sort of a meal that it's really tough. You're trying to make a bird that's not completely dried out by the end. And you're trying to take stale bread and make it into something appetizing. Tell me something interesting that you learned about the chemistry behind a good Thanksgiving meal.
Yeah, we spent a day at America's Test Kitchen. They have, as you know, a TV show and a magazine. And basically what it is dozens of professional cooks who spend all day making slight variations in recipes to make them better, 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 better. Would it be better if the butter was cold? Would it be better if you put in the flour first? Would it be better if we sprinkled the sugar instead of dumping it over and over and over? And they can tell you with certainty, and we conducted this test, that brining your turkey, that is soaking it overnight in a bucket of salt water, is the key. That is how you make a turkey that is not dry and that tastes incredible. And there are all kinds of scientific reasons, osmosis and penetration of the tissues and so on, that explain that. But that's the takeaway. You've got to brine the turkey if you want it to taste fantastic.
So now I just have to figure out where to put that really big bucket of salt water turkey this year.
Luckily, it's late November, so you can probably put it out on the porch.
We've been talking about the science of food and how food sets us apart as a species. David Pogue is a tech columnist for the New York Times, and he hosts this evening's Nova Science Now episode, Can I Eat That? David Pogue, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Kara Miller. This is 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.